back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. Wise Conversations presented by our friends at Wise Markets. I got some corned beef and cabbage, and I had a delicious meal today. I actually threw some Rofo chicken up on there, too, on that salad. It was fantastic. We're going to be getting the Maryland Crab Cake Tour back out on the road this week at Costas, and then Don Moeller is going to be joining me at Fadley's on Wednesday. We got great guests. Dan Rodericks is coming by. Thru Vignaraja is going to come by. We have some other guests, and the best part is I get to have mac and cheese and a Fadley's crab cake. Don, we got one of your old, you know, they say friends, foes, political allies, baseball. He's all wet. He's a Nationals fan. I know that, but he's had a lot more success than we've had. This is one of your favorite guests here, Don.
Well, one of my buddies, and I think Len and I like to say to folks, you know, we are an example. You don't always have to be on the same side. Len and I have been on the same side. We've been on different sides. And even when we've sparred and mixed it up, and Len and I have a lot of mutual friends, and they're always surprised. They always say to me, I'm sure they say to Len, say, you're really friends with Len? I go, yeah, I'm friends with Len. And I'm sure he says, like to think he says the same thing. You know,
always.
You don't always have to be on the same side, right, Len Foxwell?
Always, man. As I've said many times, my relationship with Don Moeller could be described thusly. Occasional sparring partner, always friends.
Well, our friendship only gets off the rocks when we talk baseball. That's when he really gets pissed off at me. He threatens the end of everything and when I start to talk bad about the Orioles. And I know it's the same thing with you with the Nationals, because you've MF'd me like flat out on Facebook for like talking bad about Max Scherzer. I know how that is.
We're going to do baseball before we get out of here today, Mr. Aparicio. It'll be two against one, I think. So, hey, man, catch us up. You're a regular here, and we're always delighted when you can find time out of your busy schedule to stop by. But Tread Avon Strategies, you've been at this now more than a year.
15 months to be exact, Don. And Don and Nestor, thank you very much for having me on again. It's always a privilege to see you guys. I'm glad to see that you are still finding time within your respective busy schedules to travel around the state and enjoy a few crab cakes and hopefully washing those crab cakes down with some good Maryland craft beer.
See, I knew that. So, 4 minutes in and we got beer on the, I knew that about you.
We've covered baseball. We will inevitably get into politics, but
what's your beer of choice? Man, you are, I always kid Matt Gallagher, if ever I'm stumped as to, I want to try a new place in Baltimore for food. It takes me only about 30 seconds. I text Gallagher and say, all right, where should I go? And Matt is the number one of all of my friends.
He's
my foodie friend. Matt is he is the food connoisseur. He should be on the Food Network. You're my beer guy. You are always sampling the latest, greatest craft beer. So which craft beer or which two or three should folks be trying right now? Because Nestor's always out looking for a good beer.
Okay, so I've been spending a lot of time this winter and into the early spring with three beers in particular, two of which are on right there in Baltimore. One is Nepenthe. Nepenthe is an amazing brewery right on Falls Road in Hampton, and it's really one of the four or five best breweries in the state when it comes to their range and creativity. They have an amazing tiramisu milkshake IPA.
Oh, come on now.
I kid you not. It's
Master.
I'm Googling this right now. You know what? Screw the crab cakes. We're just going to go on a beer tour. That's it.
Seriously, I don't know why you're wasting time with food.
Wait a minute.
I guess you need something else. Go through that again.
Tiramisu milkshake.
It's a tiramisu milkshake IPA.
Though. Hold on. Not a stout?
Yeah. No, it's an IPA.
I thought you said stout. See, I don't like IPAs. They're bitter, dude.
Well, I do have a stout for you. Tenite Brewing on the Eastern Shore in Queen Anne's County. As you're going down to the beach on Route 50, it's in Wye Mills. And they have an amazing coffee stout called Marrakesh. Okay, so it's brewed with dark coffee, but it's also brewed with notes of cardamom, ginger, cinnamon, and nutmeg, which offsets the power.
I want to
of
open a joint, make him the maitre d'. I'm gonna do it right now. We're gonna have a beer joint. I mean, you're qualified for this, Len. I mean, this is great.
I love this stuff. I could talk beer all day, and that's not why you guys.
No, but you had a third place. You had another.
You had a third one. You said
a third one. The old tried and true. When I just want to have something familiar, Union Craft. I've been spending time with Divine.
All right,
and so Maryland has really become.
I want to stand up and cheer that. That was just fantastic, bro.
We don't want to spend the whole time on beer, but Maryland has become, has it not, Len, a real beer oasis? I mean, it's the strength of the craft beer industry in this state is pretty remarkable, isn't it?
It's amazing, Don. It's one of the most perhaps undertold economic success stories in our state. And 5 years ago, we actually did a study when I was still in the Maryland Comptroller's office detailing the economic and civic contributions of the craft beer industry. And 5 years ago, we determined that they were responsible for 6,500 new jobs, $228 million in new wages, and over $700 million in annual economic activity. The industry has almost doubled in size since then. And so I imagine now we're talking about a $1 billion industry.
And so, Len, I would not have any problem finding 31 breweries in the state of Maryland in August to pair with 31. Like, there are that many. There's a lot more than you think. Especially when I drive, I see names of places popping up. And you've mentioned a few here already. We're familiar with Union or Key or things around here. And obviously, yeah, Heavy Seas and what Hugh did and like all that. But outside of the city, there's a lot more than 31, right?
Last count, I talked with Kevin Addicks, my dear friend, our mutual friend, the head of the Brewers Association of Maryland. And the last time I asked him the question, he said there were 143 breweries in the state.
Wow. Yeah. How about that?
And wow. All of them they're innovators. These are people who have taken a risk. They've drained their retirement savings. They've taken out loans because they actually believe in themselves and believe in the product that they're making. And so many of them had a difficult time surviving the COVID pandemic and the economic tumult that came out of it. And one of the last things I did in the Maryland Comptroller's office was work with Governor Hogan's office to actually shape a series of executive orders that would make it easier for our breweries, and for that matter, our restaurants, bars, and taverns to be able to survive by expanding their carryout and delivery services.
Well, Len Foxwell, founding partner, Tread Avon Strategies. Len, you've been at this now well over a year, as you said, 15 months. Give us an update on Tread Avon and Avon, and what's been, I mean, you were in the public sector for a long time. What's the main difference for our listeners that you found by being in the public sector versus being in the private sector?
Don, I'll describe it in 3 points: flexibility, freedom, and stress. The first 2 points, I think, are self-explanatory. Yeah, when I was in the comptroller's office, it was a great experience, and it's something I would never trade for the world. But I was chained to a desk. It was an administrative, it was an executive role, and I was responsible for nearly 1,200 full-time employees spread out over 10 locations. So I was sitting at that same desk, sitting in the same chair every day. Now I can travel the state. I'm meeting with clients. I'm pitching new clients. I've had meetings and Zoom calls from places you wouldn't believe, just because that's just the nature of the business. It's a mobile job, and it's a 24/7 job. And I've learned that as well. I mean, the clock doesn't stop in the private sector. I think you guys explained that to me last year when I just got started. If the client needs something on...
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. If the client needs something on a weekend, on a Sunday afternoon or a Saturday morning, there's no such thing as punching a time clock, being on or off the clock. You have to deliver. And I love it. I actually find it liberating. So that's the flexibility and the freedom. And then the third thing is the stress, because, you know, if you don't work, you know, if you lose a client, that's money out of your pocket. You know, and the state, it was very structured. You know, you had your salary, you had your retirement benefits, you know how the government works. And so it's different when it's actually your money on the line.
Well, you know, Len, I tip my hat to anyone that does what you did, to take the gamble, to say, okay, you know, I've done this. This has been great, but now it's time for me to try something else. And I watch you, and I watch Nestor for years. I watch my son. I always say the stress part that you talk about, you know, my son at Moeller and Gary Realtors, here's the bottom line, is that for years I knew a paycheck was coming every 2 weeks. You and Nestor and my son and the other small businessmen and women that I'm so fond of, if I don't get it done, I don't eat, right? I mean,
it's an incredible disconnect between my wife's 31 years with Verizon as an engineer and just has a different thing than anybody like me that's had, you know, done it this way. And I sort of think everybody's wired like me, but they're not.
There have been plenty of nights I've actually laid in bed awake just thinking about my 18 month projections look like, and balancing it against the expenses of the business and thinking, oh my goodness, am I going to make it? And I've been very fortunate. The business has been successful. And I have to say that it has been the most singularly rewarding and gratifying experience of my life.
Hey, Len, I want to ask you about Easton a little bit, because like I drove through Easton. I did not get a crab cake in Easton. I was flared out like down at St. Michael's and just in and around. So I'm going to come back through your place. But I drove through Easton. I had a delicious ice cream cone on a really rainy night in the middle of August, because we were trying to get ice cream every night and have fun and gain weight and get fat last August. Easton's beautiful. And then when the tour was over, sometime in the fall, I saw a story about Easton being like one of the 10 most something neighborhoods, you know, desirable places to live and all that. Give me a little Easton update, because one of the things I learned last August, and I haven't had you on, and I kidded the mayor of Easton about this, Jake Day. I said, we don't stop. We just drive. You know, like Moeller stops because he's got a place there, you know, Kent Island. But most of us are just in a hurry to get to wherever beach thing we're going to, whether it's Delaware, Maryland, Ocean City, the Chicoteen, Gastein, wherever you're going, we don't stop. And I think Easton, St. Michael's, Cambridge, Salisbury, they've all created places, and the Blackwater, just there's so many beautiful things, but I didn't explore Easton the way I feel like I should.
Well, you have to come back. I mean, we're going to have to come back. We're going to have to eat some crab cakes, and we're going to have some good Maryland craft beer. And I can give you like another dozen recommendations at another time. Easton is a place that I've described the people as such. You can actually go and visit some of the most acclaimed restaurants on the East Coast in downtown Easton, but it still has enough of a small town Eastern Shore vibe that you can park your car right in front of the restaurant.
Is it the Charleston of Maryland? Be honest with me.
I've never thought of it like that.
But well, I think of it as being foody and homey. And
a more suitable local parallel. And I can see the point of Charleston, but I think Easton is on a similar track as Frederick. Another small town that has evolved into a real center of dining, culture, entertainment, and the fine arts, without losing that small town appeal that made it so attractive to second home buyers and retirees and transplants in the first place.
Well, Len, what I'm always fascinated by in Easton, and I do make that 20 or 30 minute trip from Kent Island down to Easton time to time. They got a little barbecue joint right in downtown Easton that I think it's called Barbecuers. I mean,
barbecue.
That's just what it's called, right?
Been there.
I mean, spectacular barbecue. And then just about a week ago, my wife says, whoa, look at this. And I don't know if it's new or just getting started. There was like a Michelin award-winning restaurant that I think recently opened in Easton that has like some, you know, it's a menu that you would see in the finest restaurants in New York City or Los Angeles.
You're probably talking about Barus, right?
I think that was the name of it.
Yeah. I mean, and that's another interesting story. This a gentleman named Paul Prager, who is a New York financier, venture capitalist. He has relocated to Easton, and he and his team have made just a transformational investment in the town. And so he's opened several restaurants. Another that I would highly recommend, in addition to Bar Rouge, is the Ward Room, which is more of a casual menu, which pairs with amazing wines and spirits and craft beer.
But I'm looking at this Kaluga caviar on this Bar Rouge plate, and I'm thinking, right? right? I mean, roasted cauliflower soup, cauliflower panna cotta. I'm all in. Count me as.
And they really I'm telling you, it's. I think Len is right. I mean, Easton is. It's this amazing. It really is a destination. Nestor, you talk about it driving right through it. I have more and more friends who, when they're driving to the beach now, as Len said, they have certain craft breweries, Len, that they like in Easton, that one of their stops once they get over the bridge is to pull into Easton and spend some time at one of those craft breweries. You've been there your whole life, Len?
I was born and raised in Cambridge, which is another town that just it's just reemerged after an economic downturn that lasted about 40 years in the aftermath of the riots of the late 1960s. And it's becoming a thriving downtown destination in its own right, thanks to RER Brewing and a few other restaurants. So I went to Salisbury University, and then I joined the Glendenning administration. And just as a matter of convenience, I lived in the D.C. area for several years. And then in 2005, I decided, along with my wife, to come back to the Eastern Shore and raise our family here. And it was, in retrospect, the best decision we ever made.
And spent the next 15 years of your life as Mr. Little League in Easton, correct?
Oh, my goodness. You know, we just started practices this past weekend, and it just takes me back. I mean, I was watching a T-ball practice, and the kid's up there with with his brand-new bat, hadn't even taken the wrapping off the bat yet, because, you know, he had been to Dick's 15 minutes before practice, hits the ball, and then promptly runs out to the infield to retrieve the ball and give it back to his coach. And the coach is saying, no, first base this way.
I love when they run. The best part of T-ball, because my grandson is just starting this weekend, I think, the best part would be running the wrong way. I love all that.
Oh, then, yeah. I've told new coaches, I said, if you ever remember as a kid playing those electric football games where you line up the little players and then go in different directions. Yeah. And you all go in different directions. That is what a typical Saturday morning T-ball game is about. But they're having fun. And I tell the parents all the time, listen, it's not about the score of the game. It's not about who wins and who makes the All-Stars. It's about a time in your life with these young kids that you'll never, ever get back. So just take a minute, step back, and take plenty of mental pictures, because you'll look back on these days at the best time of your life.
It's special. You know, I went, Nestor and I were just talking in another segment. I saw Evan Hansen on Broadway, and then I saw it again last night downtown at the Hippodrome.
Don't give me any spoilers. No, see you tomorrow. Come on.
Cover your ears. But there's a great moment in Evan Hansen.
No,
stop. It won't ruin it for you. My wife and the women were fascinated. It's about breaking in a glove. And they said, what do you mean breaking in a glove? You know, whether shaving cream or neat foot, or you can come back on.
Man, I'm telling you.
How did you break in a glove as a kid, Len? How'd you break your glove in?
Two baseballs, 530 motor oil, and a rubber band, and rubber bands tied all together, and slept with under my pillow for a week.
Nestor, how did your dad teach you to break in a glove?
About three rubber bands around it, one ball, not two. I had a smaller glove, and my dad had this special like pink colored oil that
Neatsfoot oil.
Yeah, he put that
in a little pin. Neatsfoot oil.
It was pink oil that he like put in there, and it. I had a Tom Seaver Rawlings glove. That was when we lost Tom Seaver last year. I was sort of Len. How did you become a Nationals fan? I got to ask that, because like you give me all this. I'm from Maryland. I'm Maryland Free State, and the Orioles.
I wish I
could have gotten rid of them. Believe me, I tried back in 06. I went to the first game. David Cope gave me a Nationals hat. It looks like I shop at Walgreens, and I don't. I shop at Wise. But I would say
I don't know, Nestor. Those Walgreens hats look pretty good during that 2019 World Series.
I've met the creep that owns the baseball team here, so I'm disassociated from thinking like the Orioles are members of my family or whatever. It's been treated different, but for anybody that had a choice that said, I'm no longer going to be an Orioles fan. I'm going to be a Nationals fan. I am assuming you were an Orioles, that you were a Cal Ripken guy and trying to get tickets back in 95. I'm assuming you were that guy.
Yeah, I always liked the Orioles. I never had anything against the Orioles. But before I was a Nationals fan, I was actually a fan of the Oakland Athletics. I was a lifelong Oakland Athletics fan.
Was it the yellow underwear and Charlie Finley and like all that? Was it the excitement of Ken Holtzman's Sal Bando?
Actually, it was so strange that actually I came of age as a baseball fan after the whole, that the Joe Rudy, Reggie Jackson, Sal Bando, Catfish Hunter
Prime.
They were
the first bad guys in my life. They were the first people I hated because in 1973 and 74, they beat the Orioles. I was at the Jim Hunter Palmer game in 74. So like I was 5 years old. I remember it. I still have my box score, all of that. But like, I hated the A's. Like they were literally the bad guys to me. All
yeah. Knocked them out in both 73 and 74. Well, you can blame your own general manager for that, for dealing Frank Robinson when he still had some gas in the tank.
There are a lot of things to blame.
Don't you talk bad about Tommy Davis on this program. He was my first designated hitter.
Tommy Davis, 150 RBIs in 1963.
There you go.
Amazing.
We got him in 73. It's an Oriole tradition.
Now, this is for the Dodgers.
Could have hit in a wheelchair. We are with founding partner of Tread Avon Strategies, Len Foxwell. Let's talk some politics. Let's talk some state. Len, you're a student of the game. You're a student of what people think. How are we doing as a state? What's your sense? Take the temperature of the state for me.
Well, yeah, I think economically, Maryland has been far better positioned to ride out the devastating effects of the COVID pandemic than many other states. Obviously, we have some bankable advantages that are singular, if not, virtually limited to Maryland. Obviously, we have the presence of the federal government, which can never, ever be overestimated as an economic catalyst and as an economic firewall. We also have, an international airport, a port of Baltimore. We have some of the world's best hospitals. We have a thriving higher education sector, the research corridor of I-270. Obviously, we have because of the economic bones we have in this state, as well as the contributions that the federal government has made in forms of stimulus and investment in state governments. I mean, we obviously now have a multi-multi-billion-dollar surplus. So the question moving forward is, how do we spend the peace dividend, if you will? And obviously, I think we're going to have to take advantage of this opportunity to make generational investments in our physical infrastructure and our human infrastructure. The General Assembly, in its infinite wisdom, worked with the private sector to come up with a transformational program called Kerwin, obviously, but it's a nearly $4 billion investment in the transformation of our K-12 education system. And if we don't have a strong network of K-12 public schools, you know this, Don, better than anybody alive, our economy is not going to keep pace with that of our neighbors. We will have eaten our seed corn. And so I think I would pose to any gubernatorial candidate from either side of the aisle, how do you plan to not only make those investments in Kerwin? Are you committed to Kerwin? But also, how do you plan to ensure that we're getting the maximum results? I think we have a generational opportunity to invest in our transportation grid of roads and highways, our mass transit system, taking our airport to the next level and ensuring that the Port of Baltimore actually remains one of the primary economic drivers of our entire region.
Go ahead, Nestor.
Go ahead.
Len, as far as positioning to get out of COVID, and I don't know if we ever know where the end of it is. I mean, Don was talking about we're wearing masks. I'll be wearing a mask on Saturday night at the theater. But from a hospital perspective, we talked about this 2 years ago before all this began, and especially on Eastern Shore and other places, that this is really taxed the whole system in a lot of ways, and stresses that, and I know you served a long time in government, so did Don. There was no playbook for any of this, right? Like, for anybody in elected office to say, well, what happens if we have a pandemic and everything shuts down? There was nowhere to take cover for that 2 years ago.
Yeah, I teach a class at Johns Hopkins in crisis response, and I think we're going to have material from this pandemic to inform classes like this with case studies for the next 50 years. You know, and much like other crises in the past, such as natural disasters, or I'm even thinking about things such as the cyanide poisonings in 1982, on a much larger scale, obviously, this had the ability to either make or break careers. And people like, you know, and I don't agree with everything Governor Hogan does politically. We come from different parties, have different philosophies of government. But the way that he stepped up and demonstrated optical and substantive leadership in the early days of the pandemic in 2020, I think he's going to be remembered largely for how he navigated not only the state through the public health crisis, but how he navigated the relatively rocky shoals within his own political party. Because, you know, there's a far right contingent within the Republican Party who still believes that COVID's a myth, that masks and vaccinations are some labyrinthine plot from the federal government to subjugate the human race, all this crazy nonsense. And so Hogan had to, you know, guide the state while at the same time managing his own party politics. And I think he did a fine job. I think there are some other folks like Mark Elridge in Montgomery County, Johnny Olszewski in Baltimore County. I love the leadership Stu Pittman demonstrated in Anne Arundel County. And
it's tough. I've been with really all tough. Of these people when they've got crazy people saying crazy stuff and they're trying to save lives and keep hospitals up. Yeah. Brandon Scott, throw him in there for all, you know, shutting down the city. It's been tough. I had people, Johnny O, like, you know, 2 years ago. I don't know. It's very, very difficult job navigating that. And these were the toughest of tough decisions, like what Biden's dealing with right now.
I use the example, Len, I think you're spot on. And Nestor, you mentioned that you've sat with all these guys. I'll go back. People forget, but let's go back to the beginning of the vaccination process when folks were sitting on the computer for hours trying to get appointment. Now that you can walk in and get them, it's in the rearview mirror. We forget that. But at that time, I remember my wife and I. And again, it was cooperative effort between the state and the county. And Governor Hogan later recognized in a bipartisan way, County Executive Olszewski and his health officer, Dr. Gregory Branch, for the job that they did. But we showed up at Maryland State Fairgrounds, and the line was backed up out onto York Road. The line coming out of the Cow Palace, you know, looked like you're waiting to buy, you know, tickets to the greatest concert, like the Beatles reunion or something. And I said to my wife, well, we just have to get to our happy place that, you know, we're going to get a vaccine. And if it takes an hour or two, so be it. And I swear, Len, from the time we got out of our car, it was probably 18 or 19 minutes. It was a Disney World kind of production, winding around queues, ample workers. Then you fast forward to when they started to vaccinate children, same kind of procedure, including health department thinking of dressing up cartoon characters to interact with the children so they weren't afraid. It's really state and local government shined throughout this, didn't it, Len? I mean, it was state and local government.
I couldn't agree more. And yeah, I've actually given a lot of thought to like lessons learned from the pandemic. And I come back to a couple of main points. One is that government matters. And I think over the past few years, I think there have been times when we as a people have become so consumed by the entertainment of politics and by the allure of these outsized personalities in our process that we've now been jarred back into reality. How we govern matters. The attentiveness to detail, the logistics, the mechanics, it matters. It literally saves lives. Another thing I've learned, and I think we all have, is that many and oftentimes the people who earn the least amount of money in our society are the absolutely the most indispensable to keeping society going.
Amen. Yeah. Amen. Amen to that.
Yeah.
Well, Len, you alluded to, we're going to, anytime we have someone with your political acumen on, we like to play prognosticator a bit. Let's look at a couple of the races and what's happening. You mentioned in this state, particularly where Governor Hogan is an outlier in that he continues, most recent Goucher poll continues to get high marks from Democrats, independents, Republicans. Actually, one of the Goucher polls showed him actually polling better among Democrats. And then you talk about this small fringe, and I don't know how small, and this is my question for you, because you get around the state. The Republicans in this state have a MAGA branch. I mean, they have an Andy Harris branch, and they're running a candidate representing full-on Marjorie Taylor Greene MAGA type of campaign in Dan Cox against a Hogan-centrist Republican in Kelly Schultz. As you get around the state, is it possible for a Dan Cox to win that primary?
Yes. Yes. Wouldn't surprise me at all. I know that the plural of anecdote is not data, as my one-time political science professor taught me. But everywhere I go in this state, whether I'm driving through Harford County or I'm riding the Blackwater Refuge Trail on my bike down in Dorchester County, there are Cox Schiaffinelli signs everywhere. And I know signs don't vote, but signs are a reflection of energy and passion. And Cox has it. And Cox is actually, we're going to learn a lot from the outcome of that Republican primary, because this isn't Cox versus Schultz. Let's not delude ourselves into a minute to thinking this is about Dan Cox versus Kelly Schultz. This is Donald Trump versus Larry Hogan.
That's the race, right?
That's exactly right. And both sides, both wings of the Republican Party that are on opposite sides of the cultural and philosophical divide see it that way. So Trump is going to try to use this race as a weather gauge of his own reach into a blue liberal, supposedly liberal state.
Well, the Democrats are licking their chops that Cox would win, right? Because he'd have no chance of winning the state, right?
He would have no chance of winning the general. Kelly Schultz, on the other hand, would be a very tough out in the general election. She's smart. She's telegenic. She has a record of experience in government.
Telegenic. I don't know what she looks like. I literally don't know. If she stood next to me, I wouldn't. Like, it's me. I don't see her. She doesn't come to me anywhere, you know, nor does Cox, but the signs did. I mean, I drove all around the state. The signs did. There was a lot more of that than Schultz 6 months ago. I was assuming Larry's money would change that. Larry would go. Larry's all in on Larry, though, right? Larry's all in on president, right? Like, that's clearly not in on Senate, right?
You know, I go back to one of my formative experiences in politics. And I remember in 1986, there was a Nevada senator named Paul Laxalt, and Don will remember Paul Laxalt. And he was actually giving serious thought to running for the presidency in 1988. He had been Reagan's national campaign chair and everything. And his presidential ambitions were derailed because in the Nevada Senate race to replace him, he couldn't hold on to the seat. So the prognosticators looked at that and said, well, if Senator Laxalt couldn't even, if his brand of Republicanism couldn't even, if he couldn't even hold serve in Nevada, then what kind of national infrastructure does he have? And I think there's something to be said about that line of thinking for Hogan. If he does have his eyes set on the higher prize, he's got to show that he can at least police his own backyard and that he has enough political capital in the bank to get his chosen successor across the finish line. And so I think he's counting on that. And I think the Trumpers on the other side would love nothing more than to deal Hogan a political bloody nose by knocking off his preferred candidate in the primary.
Boy, the infighting in their own parties is something, right? You know?
Well, it's because Nestor, that person that Len is describing, I at the theater the other night, I was with a good friend who had just gotten back from a fishing trip in Florida. So you can imagine. And
oh God,
the person who takes him out on the boat down there, he's gone to the same place for years, and he loves the guy. But he said to me, I go back every night and I shake my head. He said, you have to understand that he's full blown. He's as nice a man as I've ever met. Full blown believes that the entire virus was created by China, but that it wasn't serious, that the vaccines are only there to track us and where we go. In full blown QAnon. And there's not a thing that my friend is going to say to this guy that he's been fishing with in Florida forever to change their mind. And I guess, Lynn, the question is, you talk about it. Nestor talks about it. The Cox signs are out there. Is there 50 plus one? Are there 50 plus one of those folks in the Republican Party that they now are the dominant voice in this state, and the Hogans and the Schultzes are the outliers?
So if you're looking at the Republican Party writ large, I think the answer would be no. It's not the dominant strain of thought in the Republican Party. But in a low turnout primary election like we're going to have now in the middle of July.
In July, Len.
In July.
About that. How does that change things, huh?
Well, finish the thought, I think that in a low turnout primary in the middle of July, when half the population's on vacation and people are thinking about anything and everything other than politics, if we have another gubernatorial primary where turnout is somewhere between 24 and 28%, you know those Dan Cox voters are going to get to the polls. If there was a hurricane in progress, they would find a way to get to the polls. And I say get to the polls because, as we know, Republicans are more inclined culturally to actually vote on election day than Democrats. We like our early voting and voting by mail and things like that. So in a low turnout primary, yes, we could have a situation where a Dan Cox pulls off a surprise upset of Kelly Schultz. One of the first elections I ever participated in was in 1992. And Don will remember this probably like it was yesterday. On the other side, we had a popular Republican or Democratic congresswoman in Western Maryland named Bev Byron. She was an old line Abby Spanberger moderate Democrat who was perfect for the district.
Whose husband passed away, right?
And that's right. Good Lord Byron. And was thought to be regarded on both sides of the aisle. And primary election day was cold and blustery and snowy. It was in early March because it coincided with the presidential cycle. And she got knocked off in the primary by someone from the left, a guy named Tom Hattery, who was a great guy, but philosophically far outside the Western Maryland mainstream. And that's how we ended up with Roscoe Bartlett for the better part of 20 years.
Yeah, that's a terrific history lesson. Quick reaction to the July primary. I was thinking this may be a real, and again, Len, this is the political science part of you. This may be a real laboratory experiment with mail-in voting. I said to some folks the other day, my initial reaction was, oh my God, voting in July? We used to think you'd get 24, 25% in a primary election. We may get 17 or 18. And then I thought, well, you know what? Wait a minute. We have mail-in voting now. Everyone's going to have a ballot mailed to them.
I can't imagine how hot the old Colgate Elementary would have been to vote in July, right? Like literally, right? Like to have to show up, literally, how hard that would be for older people, right?
Absolutely. And he's still with us. So, right, Len, it's going to be an interesting experiment to sit up thinking people are heading to the beach. And they say, okay, hon, let's drop our ballots by the mailbox before we head to the beach. It might show that mail-in balloting much more powerful than we think.
Well, I think we're going to have to rely on mail-in ballots as a way of making a virtue out of necessity, because you're right. I mean, it's such a substantial percentage of the population. It's not going to be in our state during the early voting lead up, and certainly not on election day. For me, I think this is a reflection of a system gone wrong. I mean, I think that whether you're Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, I think you have to take a step back and look at the experience of the last three redistricting processes, in which each one has resulted in meaningful litigation. The courts actually overturned and redrew the legislative maps in 2002. There's a very good chance we're going to see that again this year. And I look at what's happening in Maryland, and I just come to the conclusion that this isn't working. And, I think that solutions are going to be difficult to come by. One thing that I'm very attracted to, and it was an experiment that was done in Missouri, and it actually had some real potential, where as part of the Clean Missouri Initiative, they actually gave the exclusive power to drawing the district maps to a state demographer. The demographer was independent, had never been in elected politics, someone who's just a kind of a mathematician, a planner, and just basically looked at it objectively, and balancing the imperatives of a redistricting process with adherence to the Voting Rights Act and everything, to draw the lines. Something like that is something that we should probably give some serious consideration to, because this is not working.
I'm all in for that if it's a federal solution, if it's HR1. As I told Michael Steele, I'm not into universal disarmament. I'm not in for blue states where you believe in good government changing the rules and having all the red states keep it the way it was. Hey, we're coming up against the clock.
Yeah.
Real quick, we got some big races. I think the comptroller race is going to be fun. You've got a really popular Harford County executive in Barry Glassman. I don't know that Barry Glassman has an enemy on the face of the earth.
Nicest guy in the world.
I mean, right. Everybody likes Barry Glassman. So it's really going to be about turnout and D's and R's. On the Democratic side, I know you were involved early on and had some interest in that race. We've moved beyond that. But my sense is that we've got Brooke Lehrman versus Tim Adams. Seems to me that Brooke has done the real traditional hard work, and full disclosure, I've endorsed Brooke. But around the state, it seems to me that she's putting together a coalition. It's going to be very, very difficult. What's your take on that race?
I think Brooke Lehrman actually has by far the most sophisticated political infrastructure of any statewide candidate running today.
Without a doubt.
I mean, I think if Brooke Lehrman had decided at some point to upshift to governor, I think she would be one of the top tier gubernatorial candidates. I mean, her campaign has been nothing shy of remarkable, and it's been reflected in the breadth and the depth of the support she has in all 24 jurisdictions.
Yeah. She's tired.
That said, she really is. She's indefatigable, and she's strategic. That said, I wouldn't back up on Tim Adams. He is going to have the resources to compete in this race. I think he's going to, with the stretched out political calendar, he's going to have the money to stretch his budget out 3 extra weeks. He has a compelling life story. He has that blend of private and public sector experience that's going to be appealing to the voters. And his skill set is uniquely suited for the job of comptroller. So it's a real study in contrast. And it's a shame one has to lose, because they're both fabulous candidates.
Yeah, that's a race where we do have three good candidates, including, as I said, Barry on the other side of the aisle.
You're right.
And Brooke with a model campaign. Before we get to the gubernatorial campaign, and we have a real heavyweight fight. Two of my friends, and again, full disclosure on the attorney general's race, I'm all in and supportive of my friend Katie O'Malley, but also have a good friend in Anthony Brown, and have certainly indicated to the congressman that I'll be there for him should the race go his way. I mean, what, Len, is this race, you said before it's Trump versus Hogan. Is this race Baltimore versus D.C.?
I think there's going to be a temptation to look at it that way, and it may actually turn out to be that way. You know, historically, that the Baltimore legal community that has always paid disproportionate amount of attention to attorney general's races. They have always seen that race. They've always seen that office as their exclusive domain, dating back, you know, over 100 years. Obviously, this is a different time and a different political environment. Katie O'Malley is surprising me in this race. I was surprised not only by the money she put up on the board in the last financial disclosure.
Big number in a couple of weeks, Len.
That was an eye-opener. And I'll tell you, I'm down here on the shore. And again, I don't want to overweight the importance of signs, but I'm seeing Katie O'Malley signs in the front yards of some people I really respect as thought leaders in these local communities. So I know she's getting out and getting her name out and picking up some important support. That's going to be a horse race.
That's a great race. Now, finally, can you name that tune in a minute or less as we wrap it up? What's your current take on what is shaping up to be a really exciting gubernatorial race? Again, full transparency. Folks who follow me know that I'm doing everything I can to support Wes Moore and get Wes to the finish line. What's your take on that race, Len? Because it's a horse race.
And really, we've never seen anything like this. I think there are now fewer than 10 candidates running for the Democratic nomination. We have a couple of fringe candidates, but for the most part, these are highly accomplished, attractive, appealing people with real credentials. Wes Moore is one of the most charismatic people I've ever met in my life, not just in politics, but in my daily walk. And he has a really compelling narrative to present to the people of Maryland. With Wes and Peter, I think you see a real study in contrast. You see Wes has impeccable values. He has a soaring aspirational vision for the state. But what he lacks is the hands-on experience of government, and people are going to look at that. And on the other hand, you have Peter Francho, who has four decades of service in state government. But let's just say, to put it mildly, his vision and his values tend to be highly malleable and suited to the moment. I wouldn't give up on Tom Perez, and I wouldn't give up on Rashern Baker. And I think as this race goes on, I think there's going to be some holes in the games of the respective front runners, and people are going to kick the tires of some of these other candidates who may not be in the pole position right now. So I think right now you have to look at there are probably four top tier candidates that are out there, and you could even see a sleeper, you know, like a Laura Newman or a Doug Gantz or John King emerge late.
Well, the next big event that I'm looking to is, and it's a boy, I lived it and breathed it. You know it well. When trying to get that MSEA endorsement, they'll be meeting April the 2nd. We're going to have Cheryl Post on in the near future, talking about all that and schools. Nestor, it is always a good session when we have Mr. Foxwell join us and bring us up to date on what's going on. We didn't even get to baseball. We've got to have him back on and do some baseball.
Well, Len inspired me now to have a beer with every crab cake in all 24 jurisdictions. So, hey, let me appreciate you. Len Foxwell joining us. Tread Avon is the way to find him. He's out in all the social media channels that we are. And, of course, on behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Mueller, we're going to be out doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour next week at Fadley's on Wednesday. We'll be down at Lexington Market in the morning. Dan Roderick's going to join us. Dhruv Vigna-Raja is going to join us. Be talking about some city issues next week. Talked a lot about the Ukraine and state issues here, a little bit of baseball. We've mixed it all up. I am Nestor. He is Don. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. And we never stop talking. Baltimore, positive.